Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday, Diversity Radio on KHOI 89.1, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Susan Franzen, with warm greetings to all our listeners. Today's show is unusual for adding depth to stories in current newspapers. The first is an international story. Monday's local talk began with the Ukrainian national anthem and a report of the demonstration of several hundred people on the steps of the Iowa Capitol last Sunday. Thinking of AIM citizens with connections to Ukraine, I was reminded of IRIS and how it got started when the Soviet Union collapsed over 30 years ago. The person to tell us that story is Dell Christensen, director of IRIS. Thanks for being with us today, Dell.
I called you because I knew you when your organization got started. And at that time, did it have the same name that it does now, IRIS?
The organization began back in 1993 as the International Center for Community Journalism.
How did it get started?
It began, it was founded by a former Lieutenant Governor, Robert Anderson, and he had been a journalism teacher and was interested in the role at that time in the late 80s, early 90s, the role that the free press and media plays in emerging democracies, especially those emerging democracies in those former Soviet states.
And so what did you do at that time? When how did you get your recruits?
At that time, we were working with various U.S. government funding to bring over journalists primarily from places like Ukraine, Georgia, Russia, Armenia, other places that were part of that breakup from the Cold War era. And a lot of those journalists had come from areas where the government controlled the media to where it was finally what they would consider a free press. And so we were showing them what it's like to be an investigative journalist, to have transparency through journalism, and just a focus on the role that media plays in those communities.
Well, you mentioned Ukraine. Did you have any young people from Ukraine?
Yes, actually our very first journalism program, very first program as an organization was in Ukraine, was a group of journalists who came to Iowa over the course of 1993 and 1994 for various times doing internships with newspaper and radio outlets here in Iowa.
So then did you keep in touch with them? There was quite a bit to report between 1994 and
that's true. And this was back in a time when not all of them even had email, and definitely there was no such thing as social media going on to keep up with them on Facebook. So it was a challenge, but we have kept in contact with a number of them, and we've reconnected with others over the years. We've had 233 alumni, participants from Ukraine on various programs over the 28 years that IRIS has been around.
Well, when I watched the news, I sort of knew that you had students from Ukraine over the years. I wonder if that's somebody who worked with your program.
Well, I haven't seen any of our journalists on the television broadcast, although I know several of them work with different TV outlets and other media outlets in Ukraine. I do know that I've communicated with a couple that have been reporting with independent media sources and still working as full-time journalists in Ukraine at this time with everything else that's going on.
Well, that's very exciting. Have you had any others, for example, in Georgia, did you have any during their, I don't know quite what to call it, when they were occupied?
Yes, we actually had a delegation.
You're breaking up.
Okay. We actually did have a group delegation from Georgia that was in Iowa when the incursion occurred back in 2008. But yes, that was another group. It wasn't a group of only journalists, but there were some journalists within the group that was in Iowa. And what I saw from those journalists from Georgia was they recognized that when these things are occurring is even more important for transparent and free press journalists to be on the ground reporting what's actually going on, because they know that misinformation can lead to even more deaths and more difficulties in times of conflict. So I think that's the main reason that the Ukrainian journalists that I've been in contact with have decided to stay in the country, as they want to make sure that real information, the truth, is getting out.
Would you like to expand a little bit on the program in general? As I mentioned, we were involved as hosts for, and these were adults, these were like school superintendents and business people, and I remember one was a Christmas tree farmer.
Yeah, over the years, we started out with journalists, but over the years we've expanded to adult educational exchanges with business leaders, with community leaders, with educators, civil society organizations. So it's expanded quite a bit over the years.
And now, of course, your name has even changed.
We changed our name, oh gosh, I think it was back in 96, 97. So about 3 or 4 years in, the name changed as we expanded beyond journalism. And originally, the name was just chosen to be Iris, because Iris is considered a flower of peace. And the Greek god Iris was described as bringing messages from the heavens to help the people. And we just thought that that whole image of Iris was would be a good image. But then so many people, when we answered the phone, Iris, asked what did it stand for. So we had to actually come up with an acronym for it.
Okay.
So that's where we came up with Iowa Resource for International Service.
So it is in International Service, not International Students.
Correct. It's Iowa Resource for International Service.
And is a lot of your work now with students?
We do quite a bit of work with high school exchanges through the Kennedy Luger Youth Exchange and Study Program. It's a U.S. State Department program that works in over 30 different countries around the world. But we also still do the adult programs, and those are short-term programs. So our youth programs are typically a 10-month exchange, more like a traditional high school exchange program. But our adult programs are usually 3 to 6 weeks in length and more focused on a specific topic. So, for example, we've had groups that have been to Iowa to learn about rural entrepreneurship. We've had others that have learned about renewable energy, others women in leadership. So it really varies depending on the group and the countries that we bring in.
Well, it sounds like it's been a very exciting program for a number of years. Do you have any concluding remarks you'd like to make?
I would just say that this type of people-to-people interactions with other countries is, a lot of people describe it as citizen diplomacy. It's something that's needed now more than ever. And I think we should do everything we can to encourage these types of programs that welcome people to the U.S. and help us to learn from each other and about each other. And hopefully those types of citizen diplomacy efforts will reduce likelihoods of wars in the future.
That's a pretty noble goal. Thank you so much for making time for me at this very exciting time in the world.
Near Moldova.
You've just tuned in, you've been listening to a traditional Ukrainian folk song following a recollection by Dale Christensen of the first courses Iris conducted with Ukrainian journalists over 25 years ago after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Our second story is one that was prompted by long articles in both the Ames Tribune and the Des Moines Register about Bloomington Cemetery, a pioneer cemetery just east of Ames. It is of current interest because there is a question about who is responsible for maintaining it now that it is on the edge of the lots being developed off Dayton Road and has been annexed into Ames. My interest in it comes from a visit KHOI reporters made there in October of 2015. Leaving a more vivid picture than appears in these articles. So I invite you to join us. Here is Ursula Rudenberg describing what we saw there.
I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and we're searching for and finding a little-known pioneer cemetery that is just east of Ames, and we did that with the help of Marvin and Kay Scott and Susan's husband, Fritz.
This pioneer cemetery is actually known as the Bloomington Cemetery. It turns out, if you know where to ask, quite a bit can be discovered about it and the people who were buried there. Although time holds many mysteries concerning the cemetery, there are a lot of people who've been interested in it. Amy Yoakum is with us to tell us a little about it. And you are the Natural Resources Specialist for Story County, is that right?
That is correct. Thank you for having me this morning.
When we told you that we were doing this, you gave us a thick packet of clippings and lists of people whose tombstones had been in the cemetery. It seems there's been a lot of things going on since Ursula visited in the 1960s.
Yeah, I think the cemetery has changed quite a bit in that amount of time, and there have been a lot of people doing research on it.
One of the biggest differences was when I visited in the 1960s, I remember there were a lot of tombstones, and now there were really only about 10 left, and there are certainly many more than before.
The list I have, I compiled as many different sources as I could for the cemetery, and I had almost 75 people being buried there at one time. And as you know, since you just visited the other day, you can only find about 10 headstones now.
When did you visit there?
I was there most recently probably about 5 years ago, but the first time was probably about 10 years ago.
Then the Big Girl Scout Project that I learned about through the clippings that you gave me, it was reported in 1977 in the Ames Tribune, that was when most of the headstones were still there, and we located one of the Girl Scouts over in Nevada. Cassie Harrell, are you there?
I am.
First, we should probably explain how the Girl Scouts got involved.
Can you tell us, Cassie?
It was kind of a service project. Our Girl Scout leader at that time was Shirley Gray, and I'm not even sure who she contacted, but she was a member of the Isaac Walton. And so we would go camping on the weekends there, and I'm not sure exactly how we got involved in it, but through our cadet years, we would go down there and work on this cemetery.
Well, according to a newspaper article in the Ames Tribune in 1977, one of the Girl Scouts stumbled across the cemetery almost accidentally and discovered it. There was a decision of the Girl Scout troop to kind of restore the cemetery.
It was kind of a cute little cemetery, actually, very overgrown with weeds and stuff. We would camp, like I said, over the weekend, and we would go and work a whole day on a Saturday and part of a Sunday. And we would go down there and we would weed and we'd work around the gravestones to try and find where everything was. There were a lot of crumbled grave markers there, and we would take and try and piece them together and just kind of set them in an area, hoping that maybe somebody would come and restore those grave markers and set them back up. We wanted the cemetery to be a cemetery again instead of just a weed pile.
Did you find the gravestones in rows, or were they scattered?
My best recollection is they were kind of in rows to start with, and then they kind of got scattered around throughout the cemetery.
Did the Girl Scouts enjoy working in the cemetery?
Oh, sure we did.
Why did they like doing that?
It's just a piece of history.
Uh-huh.
And we wanted to try and restore it. I mean, we've got a lot of public cemeteries out there that are well cared for. And we found this little cemetery, and I don't know, just a piece of it just kind of touched our hearts, so we just wanted to take and clear it out. And, you know, some of our scouts were into genealogy and that kind of thing, too, so they liked the oldness and the vintage look of the cemetery.
Did you find anybody that you knew in the cemetery?
No.
Well, Amy Yoakum is here with us, and Amy, you gave tours of the cemetery, is that correct? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
I never actually was able to take people to this particular cemetery, but out of the 52 cemeteries in the county, I would consider about 15 of those an old pioneer cemetery just like Bloomington.
Uh-huh.
So I would take them to some of the other ones that were a little bit more accessible than the Bloomington was.
So this was what you would call a pioneer cemetery?
Yeah. I believe the technical term for a pioneer cemetery is that they had to have had less than 8 burials in the last 50 years. And most certainly, no one has been buried at the Bloomington Cemetery for a very, very long time.
You came after the vandalism. And one of the questions I'd ask quickly to Cassie is, did the vandalism happen while you were a Girl Scout?
No.
It didn't.
I don't know if somebody had vandalized it to begin with, but it was so overgrown with weeds and stuff, it was kind of hard to tell.
No, this was after you worked on it. So
it had been after we worked on it.
So after you fixed the cemetery up, did you show it to anybody? Did you, advertise to people that you had done this?
I don't know if Shirley ever did or not. None of us girls ever did. And then, of course, we also had Luann's mother, Luann was one of my fellow Girl Scouts. She would come and help us, too, and she was just very much into, she worked at the courthouse, and she was a caretaker of the grounds outside, And she would come with us and help us also. And we, I mean, digging around, finding the grave markers. And I don't know, it's just something about that little cemetery just kind of touched us.
Well, I understand what you mean. I think it touched us, too, when we were there on Sunday. There's something very peaceful about it. And I can see why you kind of adopted it as a really beautiful spot to be. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and if you just tuned in, we're speaking with Amy Yoakum and Cassie Harrell about a little-known pioneer cemetery in our area known as the Bloomington Cemetery. And Amy is a natural resource specialist for Story County, and Cassie lives in Nevada and keeps in touch with her friends from the Girl Scout troop, and you were one of the people that actually originally discovered the old cemetery after many years and helped fix it up.
Amy, while you're with us, do you have anything else to tell about the things you actually did with the cemetery? You gave us a lot of leads that we're going to follow up in a few minutes.
You know, Bloomington was one of the oldest towns in the county, and some of the burial dates from Bloomington are from the mid-1850s. So that's really quite old. And William Allen wrote the first history book of Story County, which was published in 1887, I believe. And most of the people in the cemetery are known as the really old pioneer people in the county. This is where some of the very first settlers lived in the Bloomington area, and they're very well-known names, I think even throughout today, for being pioneers that settled here very early.
Maybe if we have time, I'll tell about the way people can find out more about those people through Find a Grave and Darian the Historian.
When we were at the cemetery, we actually started to talk about Bloomington and, you know, kind of realized that this cemetery belonged to the town of Bloomington, this pioneer town. And so we decided to see if we could figure out where the town was, because we had heard there was a so-called a 10-minute walk away from the cemetery. So we have a short recording of here of us trying to find where the town was.
See a roof?
Yeah.
That's where Bloomington was. Yeah, it's like that.
Do you know how big Bloomington was?
When I got there, and I don't, that was a long time ago, my impression was that that Bloomington was about a square, about a block on the side, maybe just a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
The streets were still there as sort of country lanes, and there were some residences there. And of course, these days you can't drive to that set of residences down a driveway coming in from Dayton Road. But it's off Dayton Road.
There
it is.
Yeah. You think that house was an original Bloomington house?
No, it's much too modern. There's the house right ahead of us.
Uh-huh.
If you were living in Bloomington, you could walk to the cemetery. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of a 10-minute walk at most.
I couldn't believe that the house across the field was on the site of the former town of Bloomington, because I had the idea that the town was located on Old Bloomington Road, which still exists, connecting Stagecoach Road with Dayton Road.
You were pretty stubborn about that, so how did you finally figure it out?
Well, you know, in science fiction, it's technology that makes the journey possible. Well, in searching for old cemeteries and those buried there, the technology can give amazing help. Online, through the website of the Ames Historical Society, I was able to locate maps going back to 1886 and comparing them with what's there now. And also, one of the best maps was actually one that Amy gave me, which I never could find where that came from. But that the angle of the road showed me it couldn't be old Bloomington Road that exists today. It had to be something else.
Amy, can you tell us a little bit more about the town?
I don't know a lot about the town itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have quite a thick file of all things Bloomington at our library at McFarland Park, and that's where I photocopied the things that I gave to you. I think that there were a number of houses, a school, possibly a post office that were all laid out, but then when the railroad did not end up going through Bloomington and went through Ames instead, just like a lot of the old towns in Story County. It was kind of its demise.
Yeah, that's interesting, because the story that was always circulating when I was a teenager was that there was this town that preceded Ames and they were all wiped out by a plague. But your explanation sounds a lot more plausible.
Yeah, I was able to find out how a few people died in Bloomington, such as pneumonia, typhoid fever, and consumption, but they really didn't start doing actual official death records until the 1880s. And a lot of the people buried here were much before that. So unless it was written down somewhere, you really have a hard time finding out how they actually died.
Actually, there's a very good chapter in Farwell Brown's first book. The school, incidentally, was founded even before the town. And the secretary's report for 1873 shows the number enrolled to have been 38. With an average daily attendance of 26, the same report indicates that there were 23 males and 19 females between the ages of 7 and 14 in the district that were not enrolled at any school at that time. So there were a lot of people living out there.
One of the things that I noticed when we were out there looking at it was that the area where Bloomington was essentially an oak savanna, which you don't see a lot around here anymore, but there was definitely very, very old trees there.
Most of the cemeteries that I've found are placed because the land probably wasn't farmable.
Mm-hmm.
So right on that edge, you know, near a river, in the big trees, it wasn't flat enough to farm necessarily, kind of tucked away. And also being accessible by roads, you know, if the stagecoach road went close to there, it was important that people could get to the cemetery to visit the people as well.
So how many pioneer cemeteries are actually left?
Technically listed probably about 15, but, you know, maybe five or six of those are just random reports of a burial being on a farm, just one or two bodies that may or may not actually even be there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I would say there's around 10 that are the little ones tucked away that nobody really knows where they are.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the ones I like to take people to show them about that history of where they are.
Well, it's interesting how informal it is. I mean, when you go to the Bloomington Cemetery, it's extremely informal. It's just this little cemetery kind of randomly in the middle of nowhere with no fanfare at all.
Yeah, and there are a number that actually are you know, covered in prairie. So
mm-hmm.
if you think about, you know, those people that were buried that long ago and covered by that native vegetation, that's what it always was.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the cultural and the natural resource world working together.
So we're talking about the Bloomington Cemetery, which is not spooky at all. It's actually very lovely and pleasant place. And we're talking about the old town of Bloomington, which preceded Ames in this area, which died out kind of when Ames became stronger.
I'd like to read a little description mm-hmm. of Bloomington from Farwell Brown. The abundant woodlands to the west and south of the Bloomington village provided one of Iowa State's famous graduates, George Washington Carver, with a natural laboratory for his nature walks. He was said to have frequently walked out from the campus, through the woods, and up to the village of Bloomington on Sunday mornings and slipped into the back seat in the Bloomington Chapel. Carver, Iowa State's first black graduate, was aware of the natural resource of his native woodland area. The Bloomington Chapel eventually became independent, and many of the residents affiliated with the Methodist Church in fast-growing Ames. The Bloomington School graduates returned for reunions throughout the 1930s and up to World War II. Reunions have not been resumed since. But in the website from the Ames Historical Society, you can see huge classes out in Bloomington in the very early years of the 20th century. And, well, you can see there are a lot of children living out there. It was in operation for 90 years.
With a prairie town like this, what was there? You know, Susan has mentioned a school, a church. What else would be in a town like this, since there's no buildings left from Bloomington?
Well, Hannum's Mill, which was relatively close on the Skunk River, would have been a place where people were milling their lumber. Or Soper's Mill, which was even up a little bit farther on the river, started out as a lumber mill and then eventually turned into a grist mill for flour and wheat. So, you know, mills, post offices,
people were mostly farming around these communities.
Lots of small farms.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. With big families.
Amy, when you bring people to these cemeteries, or when you used to, did they enjoy going to them?
Yeah, there's a select small group of people that find this kind of thing very intriguing. And a lot of it is explaining the artwork that's carved on some of the stones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Story County got air compressed tools about 1900. So anything before that is marble or limestone headstones, and they were hand-carved with a wooden mallet. And some of the artwork, it just is amazing that someone was able to do that by hand. So after 1900, you know, it switched to being the granite stones, which mm-hmm. were using the heavier tools. And the artwork kind of falls off because they couldn't be that intricate after that time.
Mm-hmm. We noticed there were many that had a hand with a finger pointing up, and the baby graves had little lambs
on them. Little lambs, yeah.
Yeah. The finger pointing up is the sign of the benediction or a blessing, and then lambs and doves most often for children
mm-hmm.
as a sign of, for a lamb, the good shepherd, or a dove for peace mm-hmm. and innocence.
Well, we're talking about the Bloomington Cemetery, and there's certainly, one thing we learned is there's certainly a lot of people died young. A lot of babies died.
And several mothers died, around 20.
That's right.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Amy.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me this morning.
We've been speaking with Amy Yocum, who is the Natural Resource Coordinator. Did I get that title right?
Yes, yes.
And thank you, Amy. You're a great resource for us in many, many ways at KHOI. So it's great finally to have you in the studio.
Thank you.
This is KHOI Community Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Susan Franzen, and we have been visiting the Bloomington Pioneer Cemetery. For the rest of the program, we'll turn to the future with a look at a preschool in Ballard. We're dropping in on Miss Holly's preschool.
I'll just start out by asking you why you decided to have a preschool in the Huxley.
Well, I actually worked for another preschool in town, and it just decided that it wasn't a great fit for me, and had lots of families who wanted me to continue to teach preschool, and so God whispered to me to open my own preschool, and I kind of thought he was crazy, but I pursued it and started teaching out of Grace Epery Church while we were building our home on a small acreage here in town. And so I taught there before and then opened our preschool here in town through the statewide grant. So it's community preschool. We're a community partner with Ballard. So it's a free preschool for four-year-olds here in town. And I was able to become a community partner with Ballard. So it worked out great. It's great for families. No charge for families to come here.
Well, that sounds just wonderful. I would think your biggest problem would be saying, well, we don't have any more room.
Yes, that is. And I just do a morning session, so I have 20 students in the morning and usually get a waiting list. But, you know, things always change. Families move, and there always seems to be a few openings opened up. So, like, right now I've got a couple openings just because I have families that have just moved. I don't do a whole lot of advertising. It's usually word of mouth by other families. But yeah, I've stuck with just doing a morning session just because it works better for my lifestyle with continuing working with my animals and farm stuff. So yeah, we do a morning session with 20 students.
So do the children have any chance to play with the animals or learn things about animals?
Oh, yes. They are definitely part of the animal caretaking. We actually have, so, you know, every preschool has jobs of the day. Well, one of our jobs is the farmer of the day. And so it's wonderful. I don't have to get up super early in the morning and do chores during preschool days. But kids actually help feed the animals and clean the chicken coop. And we interact with the animals. I mean, there are days we could just go out in the pasture and get animal therapy with the goats and the donkey. They love the kids. And I always have families who say, oh, well, my child's afraid of animals. I don't know how they're going to be. And within a couple days, they're holding chickens and snuggling goats. And our animals are very used to children and absolutely love the attention. The donkey now, when she hears the preschoolers come down the sidewalk, she just has the loudest hee-haw ever because she knows that's who's going to feed her in just a little bit. And so she's kind of our morning greeter. Her and the goose, they're both the greeters.
So,
and then inside we also have, we're raising right now, we're doing a program called, it's called Ioponics, so it's an aquaponics system. And it was a professor at Wartburg College who actually came up with the idea. So we have koi fish inside in two very large tanks. We have two tanks and then plants growing on top. And so we're trying to grow our own vegetables and microgreens and stuff for the kids to be able to snack on. And so recently we've been snacking on microgreens during our snack time. And we kind of struggled. This is just, we're just starting out with them. So, but the kids absolutely love their koi fish too. So those are our inside animals that we get to interact with.
So you said something about Ballard. Is there another preschool that you're connected with that's in Ballard?
There are other preschools in Ballard. Yeah, there's but there's a lot of preschools in Ballard. There's one actually at Ballard Community School at Ballard West. There's preschool programs there. And then there's some private preschools, Lily Pad, Whistle Stop, or daycare preschools, and then Miss Wendy's.
They actually partner with the school?
Yes, we're all community partners with Ballard. So through the statewide grant for the free funding for preschool, we are all Ballard partners. I was going to say, it's just a great program that we can all partner together and, you know, bounce ideas off of each other and work together for, you know, if I get full, I can contact another preschool, or if they get full, they could call me. Kind of just work as a team. So, yeah, great preschool programs in the Ballard community. We're pretty lucky. It's funded just like the schools are for them. And, you know, it's still just 3 hours a day. Some of them, you know, if it's a daycare center, obviously they can stay there longer. But I get a lot of working from home parents or parents who have, you know, in-home daycare. So picking up and dropping off since it's just 3 hours a day. But it's great. I have families that come. I've got one this year from Collins, and I've got some Ankeny families and Ames families. So they don't have to open enroll. It's anybody can come. So there's no open enrollment. It's just offered for anyone.
Is this an unusual program, or are there other places that have this kind of a setup?
With the, you mean the community partners?
Yes.
Oh, there are other communities that do it. Not even exactly sure. I know Boone does it. I'm not sure about Ames. I don't know. There are other cities that have it, though. It's an important first step. You know, there's, even though we're doing academics, because that's part of learning, we really focus on play-based preschool and letting kids, you know, learn when they're ready. And so we don't sit down and do worksheets here. We don't sit down and do crafts that look like everybody else's. We are child-led completely. You know, the kids come up with ideas of what they're interested in, and then we focus on that. Right now, they're really interested in mail because they were getting Valentine mail. And so we're doing a unit study on mail. And then even though they haven't shown all the interest yet, I actually just ordered my bees today, so we'll be starting a beehive. And I thought the hive should come soon, and we'll be raising bees and extracting honey within the next couple of years. But this year, the class gets to help, and we're going to have somebody in local who raises bees who's going to come help us set up in May. So they'll be here to set up that. So, yeah, it's stuff that the children are interested in and can get their hands on. And then that's really where the learning takes place. And just being out on the farm has been so easy to get kids interested in nature. And I think that's something that we're really losing, that we're so focused on kids, you know, writing their letters and writing their names. And we forget about the importance of just being outdoors and being surrounded by nature and teaching kids to love nature and to take care of nature. And that's something that that's one of my biggest goals, is just to have empathy for the world around us and taking care of those things. And it has definitely worked because these kids love animals and care about them, and they've shown so much beauty and grace with just being out in nature. And, you know, we go for walks in the woods, and the discovery that happens is something that's just so beautiful. I mean, things that we take for granted every day, they'll stop and notice and talk about them, and then we could do project studies on those things. I mean, one year it was acorns. We found little beetles in the acorn, and that just took off, you know, and I thought, gosh, that's something I would have never even noticed, but they're sitting there tearing apart acorns and finding little insects inside. And so, yeah, we spend as much time outdoors as we possibly can. And during the pandemic, we actually took one of our outbuildings and made it into an outdoor preschool room, and we spent very, very little time inside our own classroom. So we were able to have shelter but also have fresh air with a big garage door open. And so we got very creative in order to be still together in a safe environment and outdoors. And they're tough little cookies. Stay in your snow pants all day long. I definitely send these kids home very muddy. Especially, you know, this time of year when it's solid mud outside and parents pick up and they get solid kids, solid mud. Because that's what they love to do. And I think it's beautiful. I'm right in there with them. So I love being outdoors, and I think that's where kids learn best. You know, they're free to run, and they're still learning. We write, we practice our letters on fence posts instead of on worksheets. We find letters around farm equipment and on walks, on signs. And you just get creative. There's so many different ways to teach kids these basic skills that aren't the ordinary way of teaching, and the sitting down and writing your letters on a line on a worksheet. And I think that's, I want these kids to love learning. And I think forcing it just pushes them further and further away from it. They don't know they're learning when they're here. They're just playing and having fun.
Thanks, Holly. It was fun to hear about your philosophy of education, as well as examples of all the fun things that you do with preschoolers. To end the show with a different kind of entertainment, let's stop over in Nevada to talk with Larry Stone and hear about what's happening at the Talent Factory.
I'm talking with Larry Stone over at the Talent Factory. It's been a while since I've talked to you.
And it has.
Yeah, a lot's been happening over in Nevada. I don't know exactly what you're doing at the Talent Factory, but what...
Well, as usual, things are moving forward. We did sell the building, so the Camelot Theater now belongs to the Camelot Theater Foundation, and we're leasing the building from them, and they plan to do a marvelous renovation of the building and the interior and exterior in the next 2 years.
Oh, well, so basically, though, right now, you have pretty much the old layout that you had before. Is that right? That's correct.
Yep.
And are you doing the same kinds of shows?
We are. We don't do as many. We're only trying to do two a month right now. Sometimes we end up with three, but we're trying to keep it to one or two shows a month.
So I guess we've pretty much missed March. What's happening in April?
Well, in April, we've got coming up Comedy for a Cause, and there are a group of comedians from the Midwest that are coming in, and they're doing a benefit for the MDA and for kids.
The MDA?
Yeah, Muscular Dystrophy Association.
And for kids, and how does that work?
Well, basically, the proceeds, the profits and everything from the show will be donated to the Muscular Dystrophy Association.
And why don't you tell me a little about that? Why is that kids?
Well, it's the Comedy for a Cause, basically, is done under the Muscular Dystrophy Association Team Kid. And I think that particular one focuses most of its money on children with muscular dystrophy. So that's where it's going or earmarked for.
And you have quite a few comedians who are involved in that, right?
We've got 8 comics from across the Midwest, and they'll entertain the audience with jokes and stories about their lives.
And now, when is that?
That'll be April 2nd, Saturday, the day after April Fool's Day.
So people will be used to laughing.
We hope so. Absolutely.
So
the next week, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. I can cut that out. Just the next
all
week.
Right. The next week, we've got the Celebration of the Doors. And this is a world-class Doors tribute. It's really nothing short of incredible. I'm an old Doors fan, Jim Morrison and the Doors. And this group is absolutely spot on there. I've never seen anything even close to coming as spot on to the Doors as this group. The young man, Kellen Potter, who does the Jim Morrison, his mannerisms, his voice, his appearance is just spot on to Jim Morrison. And the band is incredible. The original Doors group only had 3 musicians in it, other than the singer, of course. And the keyboard player did all the bass runs and the keyboards and the drummer and the lead player. And so this is very authentic music, and it's really amazing what they've done with it. Contains all the Doors songs, Break On Through, Light My Fire, Roadhouse Blues, all of the great Doors songs everybody is used to hearing from 1968.
Wow. Well, I know you do great tribute bands because I've followed them over the years, and
yes.
this sort of your signature, because I don't think there are very many places that have opportunities for really good tribute bands.
Yeah, we've got coming up in May. We've got the Eagles tribute. By a group called Hotel Desperado, fabulous group. And we've got a Neil Diamond tribute coming up from Branson. He's won like 13 annual awards down there. So we've been trying to only bring in the best of the best.
Well, I guess that we all have a lot to look forward to starting on April 2nd, right?
April 2nd, now this weekend coming up, we have the Maxwell Collins High School and Middle School doing a musical play, the Addams Family Musical. So Collins Maxwell is renting the theater and putting on their play up here. So that's going to be a lot of fun. If you enjoy children and a little whimsy and music, that should be a fun one to be at.
Yeah, I don't think you've ever done a high school play there before, have you?
I'm sorry?
Have you ever done a high school play at the Talent Factory?
No. This is a first. Their auditorium is being built, but it's not done. So they've elected to use the theater, which of course is what it was for originally, to put on their play.
Wow. Well,
and it is a musical.
Yes. The Addams Family, a musical, right?
Yes, yep.
Well, this sounds really great, and I'm so glad that the Talent Factory is back in business.
Yeah, after COVID, it's a slow recovery. But as people get used to going out, it's getting better again.
Well, of course, when you have a new street in front of you and a new sidewalk.
We do. And with the Theater Foundation, they're doing a full remodel of the inside. They're redoing the facade on the front. They're even buying the building next door, and they're going to put in a bistro cafe. And it'll have a wine bar, a wine tasting bar in it. They're putting $1.5 million into the renovations in this in the next 2 years.
Wow. Well, it sounds like things are really happening over at the Talent Factory, and those of us who've been following it since you took it over and renovated from the old Camelot are, I'm sure, all really happy to hear about all of the new developments.
Yeah, the community is excited about it, and we're excited about it, just to pass it off and on to the next generation that's going to move the ball forward again.
Well, that's just great. So thank you so much for talking with me, Larry.
Susan, it is always a pleasure to hear from you.
Great. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, places, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host for today, Susan Franzen. Together, with guests Del Christensen from IRIS, Ursa Rudenberg, Local Talk reporter, Amy Yoakum, Natural Resources Coordinator for Story County, Kathy Harrell, former Girl Scout who worked on the Bloomington Cemetery, and Holly from Holly's Preschool. At noon, you can hear a rebroadcast of Capital Week, originally broadcast on Monday at 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was a Ukrainian folk song, Tecumseh by Peter Ochusko, and Songs from the Doors. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! At the top of the hour. Morning masterpieces will follow at 9 a.m. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the T-Benz Reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you want to become a member or renew your membership today. Just hit the yellow Donate, Become a Member button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as a listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI meaningful and possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.